Hi, Paimon.
I'm sorry?
Hi, Paimon.
Hey.
Do you know what I... Hi, Paimon.
Hi.
Hi, Paimon.
Hello.
Do you know what I...
Yep.
Hi, Paimon.
Yep, is this going somewhere?
No, that's it. I just thought it'd be creepy because we could put like echo effects behind it.
Yeah.
And then that'll be like a whole like creepy opening.
Oh, nice. Okay, I'll do that.
Because we watched Hereditary.
Yeah. Should I stop the effects now?
No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried. Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, because Mama tried.
John.
Yes.
I have to tell you something.
Yes.
Fuck you. Fuck your stupid face for making me watch this movie. I'm of a delicate disposition. I've got fucking depression issues. I have anxiety issues.
Yeah.
And this movie fucked my shit up with the anxiety. I don't like it. I did like the movie, but I didn't like what it did to me.
Yes.
And let me tell you another thing, going back to our previous episode, it was nice to hear discordant cello this time. Oh, how fucking inventive.
Here's one thing that I love is that...
Yeah. Oh, man. That's really tough. You're fucking affecting my emotions.
So what I loved is that I got a text from you. It was like, oh, my God, someone should have warned me about the car scene. The next text I got from you was complaining about British Bake Off. So I had no idea how you felt about this movie.
Well, it was like 6 hours later.
Yeah, I know.
How did you respond?
I just like that.
Yeah, I'm just saying, respond to me, right?
Okay. I was in bed. I was asleep.
Oh.
But I did
look
like
at me.
That.
I can afford a bed.
But I also just like
I don't live in a pile of rags.
When I saw this movie, I was seeing it with my employer at the time. He had bought tickets for the wrong day. So when we got there, they're like, all we have is like these two seats. It was one of those like reserve your seats movies. We sat in the second row. Like, so it was just huge and loud. And so it really jacked me up when I saw it in the theater. And my girlfriend was out of town at the time. And after we saw it, I got dropped off. I was like, oh, I'll just go have a drink before I go home to my empty house. Because I'm a 38-year-old man and I'm grown up and not afraid of ghosts or anything. And
yeah.
Yeah, I did not want to go home.
Like, hi, John. You know this apartment I live in?
Yeah.
This basement apartment
yeah.
that I live in by myself? By myself, yep. That I was watching the movie yeah. and where scary monsters were in the movie and yeah. going to be my house. John, I literally checked under my bed.
So
John, I checked yeah. under my bed.
What happened to me is I had a nightmare in the middle of the night. And one of my cats, Tiger, was sleeping on me. And I sat up abruptly, sitting up, fleeing my cat off of me, who then clawed the shit out of me because I just,
Well, you deserved it.
Yeah, no, I totally did because I ejected it. But yeah, so this movie, don't watch it, everybody. Yeah. It'll fuck you up. No, I love this movie.
Fuck this movie.
I it's great. Like, I 100% agree. Like, it is a very effective horror movie in that I think it's very, I don't know if empathic is the right word, but like, it taps into shit about pain and loss that I wasn't prepared to deal with in watching this movie.
Yeah, I really like the first two acts. I think it goes to shit at the end.
See,
it reminds me of a Dark song where it just goes, I don't know, naked ghost, whatever.
See, I like I can totally see the end being very divisive. I like how bonkers the ending gets because it's this full on nightmare mode. And it works for me, but I totally understand people that lose it at that
yeah,
point.
Yeah, it just reminded me of a Dark song where it's just like, oh, I guess we'll just have like naked people in with covered in flour in the basement. Like, I guess that's what this is.
But I don't think that's like a, well, let's just do this. This has been built that all the signs are there the whole time.
No, the signs were there. Yes. And I think the end pays off, but I think the kind of the visuals of the end are a little easy. So we're building, I mean, not to talk about the end so quickly, but like it's, we're building up a world that has like real world roots with, kind of occult backing.
Mm-hmm.
And the end is an occult world with vaguely real world roots. It inverts, but I don't think it doesn't do a good enough job to get to the inversion. Like there's, we're no longer grounded at all. And I don't think that pays off. Cause it's like, so, I mean, the opening of the movie is establishing the grandmother was some kind of like hardcore occultist lady. I mean, not establishing, but
yeah,
they
I was going to say that's a.
No, but they show her necklace, which is obviously some kind of like Luciferic sigil. I mean, it's not Luciferic, but like it's a sigil that has occult value. if you know anything about any of the stuff, you look at it and go, oh, well, that's a sigil. The mother buries a book, you know, when she looks through her books, it's like her books are the guide to putting a demon in your kid. Like, I mean, it wasn't that straightforward, mm-hmm. but it's setting up the world in which the grandmother is the architect of something bad towards their family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the end of it is not, the end of it is, oh, well, the grandmother, the architect of what happens to their family in a, you know, real world occult way. And the end is Nightbreed. Like, you know, like we jump levels of
but things start getting, but I don't think it's necessarily a jump. There's that middle section where they do the ritual, which they're trying to summon. She's trying to summon Charlie. And there's a shot earlier on of a pamphlet, that same pamphlet of, hey, this medium, come talk to. So I think this is a case where playing out this way, like they've invited that evil spirit into their home, and this was that made manifest at the end.
Yeah, yes. It's just how much it was made manifest just felt inappropriately sized. Like I'm trying to like, it'd be as if Paranormal Activity or one of the like more like downplayed horror things that like a demon literally walks through the door at the end where it's just like, well, that's not tonally with the film. Like, I just feel like they kind of jumped an extra step of showing all these random people. Cause like physics is defied at the end.
Yeah.
Well, you should, no, the demon is in the kid.
Not yet. At that point, it's in the mom. Let's get there.
Yeah.
Let's
Okay. There. I think that
I understand. Cause it's totally like nightmare logic. It's insane. It's,
well,
it's,
no, I'm going with the logic on the shelf behind me, all the occult shit. It's like, no, that's not how that works. Like
the way a normal person would approach. Yeah. That's demons.
Okay. Let me put it this way in to explain how dumb I'm being right now is, you know, those car people that are like, you can't shift into a flip, 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 a flip, and from a flip, flip, flip. I'm like, but that's what I'm doing. I'm like, it's, but that's not.
It's the way when I see someone in a TV or movie playing a video game, and like they have an Xbox 360 controller, and 8-bit sounds are coming out. I'm like, what the fuck?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
it's that. All right, so getting there. So this is a movie.
We watched Hereditary next week.
This is the first feature by Ari Aster, who made a couple of disturbing shorts. There's something wrong with the Johnsons, I believe, is one of them. And I've just heard that described, and I'm like, I'm good. I don't really want to watch it. But this was his first feature, and with Toni Collette, Gabriel Byrne. It opens with an obituary thing in the paper about Leah Graham, or Leigh. I don't remember. I don't know if they actually say the name.
Yeah.
Having died. And it starts at her funeral, basically. The family is at her funeral. This whole movie is really about loss and what trauma that's handed down. So it's sort of a good starting place for that. And I think it's kind of interesting at the beginning, like some of the groundwork that's laid in terms of, you see Charlie is at the little girl is at grandma's casket, notices the necklace. This weird man kind of smiles at her, which at first just seems like you're experiencing it from Charlie's point of view.
Yeah.
It being kind of uncomfortable. And the way they introduce Charlie's nut allergy, I thought was kind of naturalistic. The way that she's eating a chocolate bar, like Gabriel Byrne, her father shows up and is like, that better not have nuts in it. And then her mom shows up and is like, does that have nuts? Because we don't have the EpiPen.
Yeah.
That just felt like a very, like, not only introducing that concept, but also the, gave you a little bit about the family dynamic. About, like, this already, there's communication issues at the get-go. And this whole movie is kind of, you know, is also about this family breaking down. And so I thought that was a neat way to sort of introduce that slowly.
Yeah, I'm disagreeing with, although you're correct, I'm disagreeing with the movie on this, that it is about, like, you know, hereditary pain being passed down.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and again, we're jumping to the end, but like just the end confirms that this is the act of a malicious actor in the grandparents' level. So it's not pain being passed down, it's sacrifice being enacted to allow for something.
But
I mean, you're right. That's why they called it fucking Hereditary. Like,
but
you're correct in the way the movie maker thinks it's happening.
But in the same way that the pain like inflicted on you from other people can be passed down.
But the note from the grandmother like makes it explicit early on, saying all the pain's going to make it worth it in the end.
Right.
You know?
But there's the movie until the third act. The movie kind of balances this, tries to walk this line of like, is this insanity as well? Because when Annie goes,
well, that's why I don't like the third act. Sorry.
Yeah. So shortly afterwards, you see Annie going to a 12-step group and talking about her mom, family experience, her dad starving himself to death.
Yeah.
Her brother having, her mom having a dissociative identity disorder. The brother her brother having schizophrenia and being, thinking his mom was trying to put people inside of him and killing himself.
Yeah.
So there's this groundwork of mental illness laid as well, which I think plays throughout. Because Annie, in particular, is fraying.
Yeah, no, I really like that. It's just at the end where it kind of, it wipes the board of it and gives a definitive, this is demons, instead of this could still be mental health.
I don't think one diminishes the other. I think both are still present.
Oh, yeah. I think it's demonstrative that, like, because the thing is, her brother that went nuts, Grandma was trying to put something in him.
Right.
He was the first attempt to have Paimon. And I'm saying Paimon because that's a really horrific demon name. Mm-hmm. And since I am of somewhat of an occult background, I'm not going to be pronouncing that thing's name multiple times on a show in the house I live in. So I'm wantonly mispronouncing the name. Usually I do that as somewhat of a joke and I try to switch back and forth saying like, oh, this is some hilarious other version of the name. But no, I'd prefer not to summon something into my basement where I live.
Because I do think look at the way, even though this stuff's happened, look how it's affected Annie. That could be true, but this abuse, this stuff has manifested, this mental illness that then gets passed on, and it's her relationship with her family that's strained as well because of all this.
Oh, yeah. Dude, that's fine. And I think that's where this movie kind of shines. I just think it monopoly with your family's it and just throws everything off the table and goes, nope, it's a demon.
You're taking it as a turn that I don't think is a turn.
Yeah.
No, I think it's all leaning to that.
Yeah. I guess I want more ambiguity in the end. This is the same thing with Dark Song. And I think this movie and Dark Song is, beat for beat, very, very similar films. They even have the raining gold thing, which, it's an occult symbol, but they show the picture of the grandmother with gold coins being dropped, which happens when the angel gets summoned in a Dark Song. And it's a mother grieving the loss of a child, which plays into it with the grandmother's friend, who I don't know anybody's name in the
Joan.
Film. Joan, yes. This and A Dark Song are sister films. They're so close to each other.
They're related. I wouldn't go so far as to say beat for beat, but there's certainly thematic relations between them.
But I think I like A Dark Song because by the end of it, what we're watching could theoretically be both of them being insane and seeing this weirdo shit happening.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of Hereditary, it feels like it is drawing a line in the sand saying the actual answer to the mystery, it's not like this is a mystery box, but the actual answer to this film is there is a universe of occult weirdness and you know, a demon is in this child.
Yeah.
Which I like the first part of the movie where it can be, there's a chance of it being the other thing. And I just think the swerve into it being fully that, I just don't think it lands well for me.
It didn't bother me when I first saw it, but I would definitely say on subsequent watchings, it's all there. The cult's involvement, and to the point that it's almost absurd, their level of involvement.
Oh yeah, I'm fine with that. I'm just saying
that even at the very beginning, when Peter is smoking a pot and blows out his window, you see someone in the trees breathing and watching him.
Yeah.
This has always been going to happen. And yeah, you're right that it is this family being acted upon. Which is the whole thing. I think Ari Aster has said it's a sacrifice from the view of the lamb.
Totally. Yeah.
But I think that's
the part I like.
But I think the misdirections are there. Not just as misdirections, because I do think these mental illness and these things do manifest themselves because it's all about a family falling apart. But it does kind of keep you on unsteady ground until it's nope, guess what? Demons.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're not, it ruins it for me. I just think it takes away. So two scenes to draw parallels too. I love her throwing the book in the fire, much like Tom Margolo's Riddle Diary and Harry Potter and the Chamber of
Bring
Secrets.
Bring this down. Yep.
No, but when she throws it in the fire and her shirt catches fire in kind of in tandem with the notebook.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really great scene. It's kind of the same scene when she throws it in the fire and then Gabriel Byrne just explodes into flames. I don't like that scene because now there's no... Oh, shit. I don't like that scene because... Now there's no ambiguity because that one can be, it's her alone watching it. Mm-hmm. So this can be a narrator we don't trust that she just thinks her shirt's on fire.
Right.
But when he catches fire, we've now 100% proven that it's a demon. And I don't know. I like it. And ambiguous reading, less mm-hmm. than just kind of like, nope, this is what it is.
Sure.
Because I think the movie just operates better that way. That's why I like the first two acts. Like, I like that there's nothing there. Like, even seeing somebody breathing there, that's watching from the viewpoint of somebody freaked out in the room or high. I mean, mm-hmm. so cool, you know? And also, like, the... Anyway.
No, I understand your point. Like, yeah. So I just watched recently, I watched this old horror movie, I guess ghost story, called The Uninvited. And it's totally this, like, British... this brother and sister find this house and they want to move into it and some nasty stuff has happened there, but they're going to crack wise and keep a stiff upper lip and it's all going to be great. Yeah. And it's wonderful. But I guess in the British version of it, they cut out any scenes where there was an actual ghost, and the European critics loved it because they were like, oh, it's all just moody and whatever. And we didn't actually see anything. And so I'm using that as a specific example, but I do understand. I do like the idea of more ambiguity. And we've talked about this before in other movies. There's one something recently, Blade Runner a little bit, Blade Runner 2049, where it's like when there's still this kind of question, the movie's a little bit more interesting, but when it finally has an answer it's a little bit less exciting. But
it's a really good point. Yeah. Like where it's shown that, no, I am not the kid with the toy. That's sure. impressive. And we're like, oh, well, now I don't.
But as far as this movie goes, and so I understand that complaint from a plot thing, but for me, like the feeling of horror, just experience of this movie, having them ratchet that up in the last act worked for me. But I understand that, like, that kind of like, oh, it's, you know.
I didn't think this comes down to my not liking horror very much.
Yeah.
That my experience with the film, I liked it better before, because the end was the part that I like, other than the car scene, which we have to get to, the end of the film was the part that I was freaking out and putting my hands over my face. And like, it's really well done, but I don't like that feeling. And it's not like I shy away from it, but it's like, I like if the first two thirds of this movie, the first two acts of this movie finished in the same kind of tone, mm-hmm. I'd be like, oh, that's a movie I'd like to revisit. Creepy, weird, introspective. Mm-hmm. That's more the style of film. But when it goes to the end where it just goes full out, like spoopy, scary stuff, where it's like, it's just, I mean, I think it just comes down to my not liking horror that much. I'm like, well, I mean, I like the promise of the first two acts, like, and then you just.
I find the first two acts much more terrifying and upsetting than the the last one.
Upsetting is the word. Yeah. That's why I like the first two acts. Yeah. But the third one is just terrifying, where it's just like, yeah, this is scary. Where it's like, well, I mean, getting scared. It's like, so as a writer, as the audience may know, I write stuff. One of the easiest things to do is to make your audience cry. It's just, mm-hmm. it's easy to evoke emotion. I think it's sort of complementary to making someone scared, where it's like, well, yeah, jump scares and somebody in the background and something moving quickly. It's like, it's not difficult. It's difficult to walk a tightrope.
Yeah, I would argue though that I don't think with one exception in the final sequence, I don't think that last sequence is really built on jump scares.
I probably shouldn't say jump scares, but I mean, like, kind of typical, like, horror, like, somebody, like, there's that, her screaming quickly behind the scene, you see her, like, bathrobe, her in the upper corner.
But I think part of the reason that works for me is that everything that's built up to this, everything you know about the relationship between these characters and the sort of tragedy of her experience, which, by the way, I will take an aside here and say, if you are watching a movie, particularly a horror movie, and a character is in a classroom, pay attention to what the teacher's saying, because they're giving away the plot.
Oh,
All the time that happens, where they're like, here's the themes of the movie represented by this other thing I'm talking about. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
And I like, particularly the subsequent watchings of this, I'm like, where the teacher is talking about, like, what's the real tragedy here? And, you know, because they were not complicit in their own fate. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah,
this is just right on the nose. But there was, like, I think one of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies has this. Just, it's all over the place.
Where Hercules plays the power glove. Yeah.
Yes.
The classroom scene, I did very much enjoy in this before it, like, crosses, because this is, like, where it's still kind of building is, Peter, is that the brother?
Peter is the brother.
Where he's seeing his reflection in the mirror and his reflection's kind of creepy smiling.
Yeah, that's like right at the end.
Yeah, but that's right before it crosses that line. And that's where it's still like, oh, Hereditary. He's kind of nutty too. Like, this is paying off the title. Like, and then when it stops paying off the title, we're like, duh. But all right, so early on, let's cycle back to the beginning because we've already kind of covered the end. boy, do they make dollhouses creepy, and I love it.
Yeah.
Because they make it not whimsical, but like, they make it art in certain parts, But then just like a subtle lighting change and a subtle camera shift makes it the creepiest shit I've ever seen in my fucking life.
Well, and it's effective on a number of levels in terms of it's the movie starts with this like close up, or it's like this long shot of this dollhouse, and it zooms into this one room, and then Gabriel Byrne enters that room.
Yeah.
And it's this effective thing, not only in the way that shots are or done later, where it's at a sort of a distance where there's a force, you get the sense of a force larger than this family operating on this family, that they have kind of no real agency and this stuff's kind of happening to them. But it also, you learn that these things are created by Annie as like an art piece that works again for her character, is that she doesn't process anything that she's dealt with. She just makes it into these little art things.
Yeah.
Like that's her way of kind of controlling things.
And that's what I liked about the little girl doing the same thing with the bird head.
Yeah. Is that again, an example of hereditary. Is that like, is that passed down from her mom, or is that Paimon doing, because he's an
artistic.
Don't
bring him into this room.
pie
chart is
pie chart. Yeah. One of the subtle things that actually drove me crazy in this movie, I think just part of the having, working in a creative field and having client expectations, is the looming threat of Annie's art show.
I really like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That like, so she has that, she's supposed to have this gallery showing while all this stuff eventually is going on, and they're still like asking, and they're very nice. They're like, we're excited to see your work. Do you have anything to show us? Whatever like that. That like tension of like, I'm living a life and I also have to deal with this, but somehow not even just being able to go, they give her outs left and right, but she can't just be like, no, and said she'd rather freak out about it. That was this super stressful element for me as well.
Yeah. The phone call, which I thought was really nice, is after Charlie's thing of them being like, I don't even know what to say. Like, do you want us to push it back? Like, the empathy through the phone was really great. And I thought that was nicely paired with Joan's fake empathy. Because it's about the, you know, that's when Joan gets introduced. So it's like there's true empathy, or at least what we understand to be true empathy through the studio. And then Joan's fake empathy, or like there's, it's a nice.
What you think is real empathy at first.
But so, all right. So, we're kind of skipping around a bunch, but who cares?
We're too late in the game for this now, but God damn it. Don't listen to this before you've seen the movie. Go see the movie. Go as cold as possible. They should know by now. But,
So the tricks, so when they do the first seance, when they go to Joan's apartment.
All right. So I feel like that's several steps in terms of what happens. You have this sort of.
I was thinking that I forgot the Charlie thing happens before that.
Yeah.
I was thinking that was a grandma thing.
Yeah.
Sorry. Quickly before anything else, did you notice how fake ass Peter's weed looks?
Oh yeah.
That first scene, it looks like it looked like tobacco.
It's
like,
all shake. Yeah.
No, but not even shake. Like it was like brownish, like yellow. Like it looked like light tobacco. It's not 1976. We know what like it's legal again, in most of the country right now. This is very weird to me.
I say again, like everyone's listened to the last episode, but from the flyover states, whatever, like weed was whatever in a bag. So,
but it's this movie came out in 2018.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying. I'm saying people are still stupid. It's all right.
Doesn't take
place. Not everyone's down with them sick nugs, bro.
It doesn't take place on Jupiter.
But you can already tell tension in the family. And by the way, we need to talk about just how fucking great Toni Collette is in this movie. I think this wouldn't be nearly as good of a movie if she was not. She's the glue that holds this whole thing together, because so much is required of her in that character.
Really shines above everybody else. I think Peter did a really good job as well. Yeah. The only people I thought were struggling, I think Charlie did fine for child actors.
Yeah.
Gabriel Byrne, again, cannot do an American accent to save his fucking life. Every time he got excited, his accent slipped, and it is infuriating to me that this man is a well-respected actor, and he cannot keep a fucking accent straight.
Much like the Gary Oldman thing,
if you ever rewatch this movie, any time his voice gets raised, it's like...
Oh,
I am from Idaho. But I'm really mad at you.
I forgot that every time he also goes, toot-a-toot.
I know he does. I know. It's like, oh, go over there. Oh, you believe in your leprechauns going over the rainbow. But your good Lord Pied Church will come down and put the rain and things on top of you.
But
no, his accent just breaks down horrifically anytime he raises his voice. And it's like, dude, you're Gabriel Byrne. You're a really good actor. You're well-respected. You could just say my character's Irish. There's no reason this guy couldn't be Irish in the movie.
Well, for what little you kind of know about him, I guess there was perhaps an earlier version of the script where he is a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and Annie was one of his patients.
I picked up on like, that may have been his job, the way that they show him in the office. I felt then, psychiatry.
Yeah, and
vibe.
When he's like, yeah. When he's writing, you just get a glimpse of this when he's writing to another psychiatrist and is writing to a psychiatrist and is like, Annie's on the verge of or in the midst of another breakdown, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very subtly done and very nice. But yeah, you don't get a whole lot of sense of him other than being somewhat of a rock in the family. That being said, everyone in the family betrays each other at a certain point in the movie, for good or ill. His sort of betrayal in not wanting to burn the book. Don't know if things would have ended differently.
You think that's a betrayal?
Well, in terms of like,
I'm not questioning it. Yeah.
Not believing in his wife, like right. not supporting her anyway, or just like and it's not like that. Like it happens then, but like throughout, he's already kind of like siding with the son and all this stuff. Like,
yeah, totally. He does the my son thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a good thing to kind of like dissect a little bit is what do you do in that? Like, so he's the most grounded.
Yes.
In the paranormal world, you call it materialism.
Just kind say of, muggles. I know you want to say
he's
muggles.
He's a muggle. And literally, that's why I was trying to say another word. That's why I started with M and tried to yep. find a different word for it. So he's a muggle. But what do you do when, because the only evidence he has that there's something there is that there's a dead body in his attic. And uh-huh. But I mean, the fact is, he thinks it's his wife.
Right.
And
there's absolutely reason for him to.
Evidentially, he should. So like, right. What do you do when your wife freaks out and be like, should I throw this in? And especially as a psychologist, do you feed into the fantasy? Do you throw the
right?
There's a really good, and this is part of the movie. Kind of I like until he catches fire. It's like oh, right. Fuck.
Yeah, but it
I mean, though, very surprised when he caught fire. I'm like, oh, shit.
But even before it gets to that level, just like her at the beginning talking to Peter. Peter's going to go to this party with some friends of his. And just there, it's almost an improv exercise where they're just responding to each other in questions.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just this really uncomfortable distance between them at that point that you can kind of take at that moment of like teens, you know, and they're not that close to their parents. But it also just seems like a strained relationship there.
Yeah. Before it was explained, the kerosene story that she sleepwalked and poured kerosene on them is I thought she had molested them or there was molestation in the family because there's that kind of there's something very wrong, yeah. Something very unspoken in this family.
Yeah.
And then the fact it's called hereditary is, well, maybe the grandmother was some kind of, yeah. You know, pimped out the kid. Like, there's something, I mean, maybe that can be a read of this, that this is the, yeah. You know.
Well, interestingly enough, like the trailer for this, because I remember seeing the trailer before a couple of movies, and the trailers really made it seem like the grandmother was bad, but now she's back as the child. The movie was very much not that.
Yeah.
Which I'm glad it wasn't that. But, you know, marketing can really screw up a movie. And I brought up this example before, but like, What Lies Beneath with Michelle Pfeiffer and Harrison Ford, how the whole twist was that Harrison Ford was the murderer, but the trailers were all like, Harrison Ford's a goddamn murderer.
Yeah. So the trailer, and I watched it, and I was like, oh, this looks really good. I thought it was the story of this little girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the way you play it off. And so we should get to the shock scene that I send you the text.
So eventually, Peter's allowed to go to this party, but he has to take his sister, who does not want to go. Because she's very uncomfortable and
weird. I was
weird.
So in her shoes. I'm like, oh, fuck, don't take me to some fucking high school. Fuck this. Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, her mom makes her go. And it's a party. Everyone's hanging out. And the Chekhov's nut allergy mm-hmm. shows up in that he's trying to get her just like, hey, go eat some cake.
Because he's trying to bang
smoke
the Bechdel test.
Yeah, I want to hang out with Bechdel test and smoke some weed. Go get go eat some cake. And the cake's been made with nuts. And so she, like, then breaks in on his smoke session. And is like, my throat is closing up. So he's freaking out. He's trying to take her home or to the hospital or something.
This is a shitty mom. Just to go back. You have an EpiPen on you.
Yeah.
All the time. Especially if you're going, like, oh, my teenage son is going to take my teenage daughter somewhere. You have a fucking EpiPen on you. There's no way they don't have an EpiPen in the car or on the girl.
But they've already established that they don't always have it. Because when they're at the funeral, she's like, we don't have the EpiPen. And there's also,
and
I
don't want,
I, yeah, yeah, yes, 100%, because yeah. I do feel like there's also, later when she kind of admits that she gave Charlie to her mom, you could also maybe posit that there's not a overt death wish. I mean, she's already tried to burn her son before like that, but there is this like not loving element there.
Yeah. Well, especially, and that goes to because we're not going to get to it. I'm so glad this came up. When she said, I gave Charlie to my mom, and then you show in the model the grandmother suckling the child, the grandmother's tit being out. It's like, that is fucking creepy.
Yeah, because she mentions it earlier, like that she wanted to feed her. And
No, but in my head, when I heard she wants to feed her, I picture a Gerber's can or whatever, feeding it. But no, but in the model, which she models real life, is the tit. Oh, that was like, oh, shit. Yeah.
Which, honestly, we skipped over one of the, and this only happens like one other time, but this is honestly like the scariest thing in the movie to me, and the thing that I think about a lot. Right after her mother dies, like very early on in the film, Annie is in her studio working on things, and she turns off the light and sees her mom in a dark corner.
Yeah.
Just standing there. And it is a terrifying image, because just like the way it's lit, where it's like it's dark but you can still kind of see a person there, something about that just really got to me. And it's not even like a horrifying, like, oh my god, it's more just this creepy, uncanny thing.
That's a great
image that just stayed with me throughout it.
After the scene that we're about to discuss, there's a lot of that too, where it's just like, oh shit.
So rushing to get Charlie home, they drive by this pole that we've seen earlier. Well, they don't drive by it. Peter sees a dead something in the road, swerves.
Oh, wait, no, they established the pole earlier, though.
They establish the pole earlier.
Has the symbol of pie chart on it.
Yep. Her larynx is closing. She's freaking out. Rolls down the window, sticks her head out the car to try to get air. He swerves to miss a dead thing in the road. Her head hits a pole.
Oh, Jesus.
And you just see his reaction. And one of the horrifying things to me in this movie is the knowing that, like, holy shit, this might be exactly how I would have handled this. Because in shock, he just goes home.
He looks in the rearview mirror, can't make contact with the body in the back. Like, he doesn't see it. He sees it, but he can't register it. The shock of, like, the...
Yeah, the sound is unfortunate. Yeah.
Is so good. And him just parking the car terribly in the driveway and just curling up in bed.
And going home,
Then horrible scream from the mother when she finds the body,
mm-hmm.
and you just see him in bed, and you just hear the scream from outside is so fucking good. Yeah. And that's when I texted John, audience at home, what the fuck, you should have warned me. Because again, John, I'm alone.
Yeah.
Do you know who I have as a support system? You.
Harry Potter.
No, I have no friends. I don't have a girlfriend. No one loves me. I'm alone in my shitty apartment. And now there's a headless girl and there's monsters and everything's scary and I have no one to talk to. And you waited hours to text me that. I had to talk about the Great British Bake Off to get a response from you. John, I was scared and weren't there for me.
Because I didn't want to say anything. I wanted you to experience this the way, like, in a theater you experienced this.
Oh, yeah. And then you'd go home to your loving girlfriend and house and cats. Yeah. Oh, you fucking asshole. Your fucking life is great. I'm sitting here. Look at this shitty futon. Oh, how dare you. Yeah, that was what a great scene.
Yeah.
Like, just – and then – oh, and then – so when the mother – this broken scream and they cut to the head on the road covered in flies.
Ants.
Oh, yeah, ants. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
So good.
And this is like – this mother has lost her mother, who has been this domineering force in her life. And then, like, within weeks, her child has died.
Yeah.
And it's so rough. And then you just get this complete family breakdown after that. A super long time for a lot of the movie, because her relationship with Peter is absolutely strained. And that dinner scene with them is so great, where she just lays it all out, where it's like, I know – that you feel bad and it was like an accident, but here we are, and she still has these feelings. And what do you do with that? And you eventually find out that there's more stuff behind that in terms of she used to be a sleepwalker and tried to set him on fire one night. And I mean, so much of it is related back to her relationship with her mother and the reasons for all that. And like how she hid Peter from him for a long time. But that's all presented in this way of more of a parent-child communication breakdown versus, like, I know the occult thing is happening.
Well, that's what I liked about it, because also the first kind of proof of the occult stuff is – the first full proof is when the father catches fire. But that is thematically related to her wanting to burn the kids. So everything else can be written away. And I thought that's like this brilliant, like, so her sleepwalking is, I want to burn these kids with kerosene. And then her wanting to burn the book and burns herself. It's like, oh, this is the guilt of a mother, you know, kind of passing down. Like, that's, you know, I'm not going to, we've already judged the end. We've already pretty got it. Well, but like, these are the kind of the scenes where we're like, oh, this is where this movie's fucking cooking.
Yeah.
It's cooking with fire.
There's
the fire from the kerosene that she poured on her children.
There's a couple of supernatural moments leading up to that.
But they're supernatural moments from the flawed narrator perspective. That's the first time that there's two people in a room that is demonstrable a thing is happening.
Sure. Well, what I'm talking about is the for lack of a better word, I'll call them the shimmers. So before Charlie dies, when she has, there's a moment where Charlie likes making these weird little toys. And at some point when she's doing her schoolwork, a bird hits the window and she cuts off the bird's head.
Which also happens in the Dart Song. Not the cutting off the head, but the bird.
But the bird hitting the window, When she's at home putting together this toy with a bird's head, this little shimmer like flashes in and like hits her, and she kind of looks up, walks out, and that's when she's like sees her grandma in the field of fire. And then later, like, Peter gets that a couple of times. No, but just like I'm just saying that these supernatural elements are happening throughout.
You know, totally. Well. But what I mean to say is, like, those are paying off the title of Hereditary. That can still be dissociative disorder. That can still be improper. Like, the first time you see, like, it's because even like, so what I was going with earlier is like the Joni stuff. Charlie gets her head knocked off, and the mother starts to go back to that grief counseling place she went
which
to earlier.
She never tells Gabriel Byrne about. She's always just like, I'm going to go see a movie.
Yeah.
She's just like, I'm leaving the house to go see a movie.
So she tries to return there, and Joni sees her and says, wait, I was here last year. How's your mom? Oh my God, your kid's dead. Freaks the fuck out. Let's hang out, have tea. They foster this relationship, and it leads to a seance.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing in the seance is, if you know anything about like kind of Victorian spiritualism, is the things they showed happening, cups moving and writing on a chalkboard, those are huckster tricks from spiritualists.
Mm-hmm.
They're demonstrable. You can see how they're fake. They're just old fake things. They're fakey McFakersons. The same as ectoplasm coming out of the mouth. I don't know if you've ever seen those pictures of the... These are, like, they know how these were faked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's also a thing called table tipping, which is another kind of fakeable deal.
Uh-huh.
The fact that those were the things that proved, in quotes, the spirit being there... This again leads to this is why I like this movie, because it's that didn't prove anything if you know the background of those. Because it's like seeing that cup move, I think, to if you don't know what the background is to that, might seem, but it's that same thing. It's like cold reading, right? In like a, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
I think you can get it.
Yeah, but I would say, and this is actually a bit that I like that's repeated. So when Joan eventually like meets her later. And is like, you won't. And I love this whole scene. It's like outside of an art supply store. And Joan is like, you wouldn't believe it. This sounds crazy. I met this psychic. I went to this guy psychic thing. It was great. And just Toni Collette's reactions to all this is just like, oh man, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
But like, I'm happy that you're happy. It's just such a great performance. And the fact that it's confidently done in just one.
Yeah.
From a little bit of a distance of them talking.
And also like later when she goes against the Dauphin. You know, Joan of Arc. fuck you.
No, that was a of respect. But like, so then, she brings Annie over to her house to have this seance thing. And yeah, they do this sort of moving of the cup. And then you like her, because Joni has said that the reason she's at this, that her son and grandson have died. And at the seance, she's conjuring up her grandson. And the grandson loves, I love you, Grandma, on this chalkboard or whatever.
Yeah.
And Annie looks under the table. And the camera follows her looking under the table, which I was thinking about this when we were watching it, thinking about my complaints of The Conjuring and how I was upset that, like, they wouldn't stop moving the camera, or when they would do these camera tricks, it would take you out of it. Everything in this I felt very, like, was very motivated or, like, served a larger purpose. Like, when the daughter is dying, or the daughter is being buried, and the camera like moves kind of under the ground. It kind of gives this sense of, again, something like looking afar at these things, like they're dollhouse people. And even her like looking on the table where the camera kind of follows her down, centers that action on her and her experience, because so much of the movie has been her experience for this, so much of it. So I think there's a way to do these camera trickery things that serves a story. This is just basically reaffirming that I'm right about The Conjuring. But and also to say that I like the camera work in this movie.
No, it's really good.
But when she looks under the table, and then later when she does it, when Gabriel Byrne looks under the table.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I thought that was a nice little bit. But I think for what you're saying, I think it still holds true in that those are the tools of the hucksters. But when she does it at home, and then she ends up, Joan is like, here, take this sheet I got from this guy. Say these words. You got to have your whole family there. Say these words and then do this thing. And then like the seance thing actually happens. The glass goes flying. She starts speaking in Charlie's voice, like this, you know, sort of a disassociated thing again. Yeah, yeah. But it does sort of make you question that hucksterism. I think it totally works. I think you're absolutely right that it is this hucksterism, but then it twists it a little bit.
I forgot that. No, because I think that's the first time that it's like, no, this is demonstrable something that's outside of the norm, because that she's not faking. And I should say, just because I there's three people I know that listen to the show that are going to be annoyed at me. I know the chalkboard thing is not exactly the same huckster thing, but they had ways of writing on stuff. You didn't see the chalk moving, but fuck you, it's close enough. I'm pre-predicting their annoyance.
But it's also the feint of Haunted House movie, where like it seems like, oh, now they've invited this spirit in their house.
Oh, yeah.
Now what's going to happen? And it doesn't really go that way exactly. Yeah. Her relationship with Peter is strained. And I like that because Peter is so, like, that kid is so broken after his sister's death.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very well played.
Yeah. And that's like, the scene where he flips out smoking pot on the bleachers.
Yeah.
There's, because I've had a really bad panic attack in front of my friends when I was young. Like I've only had it once when I was really, actually I was on mushrooms and had a really bad trip. And I didn't go this far, but I was there with him and he goes, hold my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a, like, you could see the friend going like, ugh, I don't want to hit your hand. That's, you know, like, that's such a, you know, a modern toxic masculinity thing. But like, I thought that was this encapsulation of all the pressures going on right there.
Mm-hmm. But before that, him just sort of being in school and everyone kind of like looking at him.
Yeah.
That was the thing I like. As someone that suffered my dad died when I was 19, and that feeling, he didn't get decapitated in the car I was driving, but that feeling of like feeling outside of everyone else because of this trauma you experienced and like people kind of looking at you, so, 'cause they know what's going on, but they don't actually know how to, you know, they haven't had that same experience or whatever. And you feel this weird outside thing. I thought that was demonstrated very well in that movie too, but it's got the added element of him actually being responsible as well.
No, John, just, real quick, did you throw his journal in a fire at any point?
I am not on fire, so clearly I did not.
Did you get somebody else to throw his journal in there?
Moving on.
Okay, so you're good. All right, you're off the hook.
No, but like just that.
I was going to get you off the hook. Don't worry. At no point was I going to blame you for your father's death here. I'm not heartless.
No, I don't. Like, I don't need you to do it. I do it all the time.
That's where I was going to get you off the hook. But fine, we won't have a therapy session. All right, it is your fault.
But the way that that it kind of manifests that, like the way that it is still about trauma, even with all the supernatural stuff going on, is one of the things I like so much about this movie.
Yeah.
And just about that communication breakdown in the family and all this stuff, that even though they are, it turns out, being acted on by demonic forces, that so much of that stuff can still happen. Like the way Ari Aster talked about it in an interview was like, you see these like let's say like a Lifetime original movie or something like that, where or like some famous dramas where like someone dies and the family goes through some turmoil, but like something happens and they all come out of it stronger and more together. What if that didn't happen? And that's basically what happens here, is that these deaths just tear the family further and further apart.
Sort of, though they did come out stronger together because they did manifest one of the eight lords of hell onto the planet. So, I mean, talk about like family planning. Grandma did. So, I mean, she is the matriarch.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as far as like who runs the family, I mean, they kind of did work together.
They didn't knowingly work together.
Yeah.
This wasn't by choice.
You know, sometimes you have to, like, you know, look. You know,
if I murder you, that's not us working together.
No, but like
me murdering you.
You know, the people that run Walmart, it's like they didn't know they were going to destroy the planet, but still, they did the work together, and that's true. Family-run business.
We should respect that.
Exactly. I'm just saying, respect the work. of a demonic older lady.
Yes.
I also like how it's sort of like the kind of that there's no morality tale to this, going back to last week's show, that the grandmother seems to have had a rad fucking life.
Yeah.
She's like hanging out with her friends and lifting her on her shoulders, throwing gold at her. Everything's fucking aces. Yeah. Lord Pychart's fucking loving her. Yeah. And she died happy. It's like,
but I mean, imagine that belief that you're like, this is the thing I believe in. And like, look, my kids, like, they're going to suffer, but so much good is going to come out of this. And like, I'm willing to make that sacrifice for you to make this happen.
Yeah, it was. I like her finding that note early, like not early in the film, but they found the note in the seance thing.
Yeah, it's pretty early on where she's like, please don't hate me.
Yeah, all these sacrifices will be worth it in the end. Yeah.
That is still this sort of ambiguous.
Yeah, but it kind of, once you realize what the sacrifices are, what the horrors are. There's a great scene around here in the film as the things start breaking down where she walks in, like, I think Peter's having like a bad dream. She wakes up and she's like, I never wanted to be your mother.
Yeah.
And she gives a scene of like how she tried to have a miscarriage. It's like this epic, like, woof.
Yeah. It's this total just awful, awful thing, which there is some question about. I read it posited that at that point she is a Pychart, because Pychart is the knower of secret things and will answer any question you ask. I don't know if I 100% buy that as much as like she's sort of in this fugue state and gets broken out of it and like is caught off guard.
See, I don't.
She's emotionally raw.
Yeah,
is see, more I what don't, I took that as.
And this might just be me being like kind of obeying the rules of the cult here.
Mm-hmm.
But the way the ritual is, Paimon is supposed to be manifest into the girl. The girl is supposed to be sacrificed so it can be brought into a healthy male host, mm-hmm. that being Peter. At no point does the mother have a demon in her. The mother is just, you know, maybe influenced by some kind of mm-hmm. forces, influenced by the grandmother, certainly. But at no point did the mother have a demon in her, which were her words the words of something else.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to that conversation, I think it's more her being kind of mentally fragile. And I do think, like, again, like earlier, I wasn't trying to say, like, you can't both be mentally unstable and have occult forces pressed on you. But like, I think at this point, it's more the mental instability enacting on her that she is obviously under tremendous stress. She's had a really shitty life.
Uh-huh.
Her mom, not the best mom. And then her talking to the child is just, she just starts, you just, you know, gutter mouthing at him.
Yeah. You really get the sense that she is really uncomfortable in her role of wife and mother. But I will say that I don't think that, and we'll get into it towards the end, that I disagree with it. No point does she have the demon in her. I don't think at that point she's got Pychart in her.
Yeah, I guess in her is the wrong term. I mean, there was not a manifestation of one of the lords of hell or one of its things in her. Like, it wasn't moving her body. Now, it like controlling her and making her do horrible things, but I don't mean like it was actually manifesting her. Because if it could be so easily manifest in her, this entire work would be pointless.
Right.
It could just pop in at any point. Like, that's too easy. It's like that superpower thing. Like, Superman is a boring character because his powers are too big.
He can just do it.
So if you have a devil thing that could just pop in anywhere, it's like, well, then they would just win. The whole thing is you have to have this grandmother that's willing to sacrifice two generations of family to have it manifest.
Yeah.
Is more what I mean. Like, not necessarily, like, because obviously she's floating in the goddamn air, cutting her fucking head off with like a G-clef fucking, you know.
The Wyclef Jean.
Yeah. What are those things called?
Piano
wire? Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. No, garrote is what I'm thinking.
Oh, sure.
What's a garrote with a piano wire? Is that a certain word for that?
I think that's it.
Yeah, I guess that's it. I thought there was like a better word for it. I guess there isn't.
I feel like garrote is the more professional term. Like, if you're a hitman, and a piano wire is just the piano wire.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I mean, but the point is, Brad Garrote, one of my favorite actors.
He's so great, and everybody loves murdering Raymond.
Yes. Everybody loves Pyman.
There's just these great family breakdown moments, and Gabriel Byrne is increasingly untrusting of her. And siding with Peter because she keeps just freaking out at Peter. Meanwhile, very early on, we skipped over this because the movie just does it and makes you like, don't worry about it. Very early on, Gabriel Byrne gets a call from the cemetery.
Oh, that's right.
About the grave and there being some kind of issue with the grave.
Yeah. Hey, what do you mean there was desecrated?
He's like, too, too, too.
Yeah.
Someone's finding me Lucky Charms.
Yeah. Oh, even there's pints of whiskey on the side. Oh, I'll be there in a second.
But so eventually, like, Annie is just going further and further into madness. Eventually, like, she finds in Charlie's journal drawings of Peter, like, with his eyes crossed out.
This is so first. So before that, they do the seance at the house. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where Gabriel Byrne, like, somewhat starts buying into these things, but not quite.
Yeah.
And that's when the drawings start happening with that. No one in the room. You see the drawings happening.
Right. And then Peter starts having freakouts, like seeing his sister in the corner of the room. And this was a great moment where he sees Charlie in the corner of the room, much like the same way you saw the grandmother earlier. And her head appears to fall off and then becomes a basketball that rolls towards him. I thought that was a great thing.
Yeah, that freaked me out again, living by myself in a creepy basement apartment.
And then these hands come through the window and start trying to pull his head off.
Yeah.
And he starts freaking out. And then he wakes up to his mom being there.
Oh, yeah. And this is where the miscarriage speech happens.
No, this was a little bit later than that.
Oh,
because,
okay.
Yeah, because that happened later when she – because she – that happens in a dream because she starts seeing, like – ants crawling all over everything.
Oh, that's
right. And then, like, she, like, wakes up and goes into Peter's room and has this whole discussion with him, and then it ends with them both being on fire. This is all just happening in her head. It's her to herself saying these things. But he's convinced that she was trying to pull off his head. She's like, no, you were having a nightmare. And then Gabriel Byrne's even more pissed off about that. And she just keeps spiraling downwards, tries to go find Joan, and Joan's not there, but, like, you see inside Joan's apartment that she has this weird tableau set up.
Yeah.
Peter's picture and, like, Charlie's toy.
Yeah, it's just all hexy shit. Yeah.
Well, there was a little tell earlier where she has this placemat, or this doormat, and he's like, my mom used to knit these same kind of things for me and my kids. And she's like, oh, that's a crazy coincidence. And then later, when she's digging through her mom's old stuff, she finds her little, like, pillow thing for Annie and one for Charles, which I thought was a nice little subtle thing.
Yeah. The you know, Charlie was supposed to be it, but, you know, should have been a male.
Yeah, I think Charlie even says something about wanting to be a boy or...
Yeah, like, they have this conversation about the mom being a tomboy and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting how much Charlie knew because she plays it as, like, this kind of non-neurotypical, it seems to be the way she's playing it.
Well, there's an argument to be made that she is pie chart the entire time she's Charlie. Because being so uncomfortable and strange in this body.
Yeah. I would not disagree with that because there's a certain weirdness that happens that entire time, but...
But one of my favorite scenes, so throughout, you've gotten a couple of instances of Charlie has seen a person later, you figure out it's a cult member, like, in the distance waving at them. But when Peter, who's just frazzled, like, so much emotional shit is happening to him, when he is at like, sitting outside alone at the lunch table, and Joan is across the street, and you can't hear anything else, you just hear Joan, and she is screaming at him, I expel you.
Well, yeah, she's saying the names of higher demons and then saying, I expel you. Yeah, it's weird.
And that is right before his big possession freak out with the creepy face in the window. But before that is actually a scene that I really like when he's in the hallway and that same thing happens, that same kind of shimmer comes down and hits, like, whatever door in the distance.
Oh yeah.
And you just see, like, someone in there, like, making some kind of, like, it looks like a come here motion. That is some Lynchian shit.
Yeah.
That really creeped me out. But he eventually, gets taken over by this demon thing. It starts, like, his hand gets all twisted and starts banging his head against the desk in a very terrifying scene.
Well, so this is where it's still, I mean, although we've now kind of relented towards the paranormal at this point, but, like, that is, like, if you have, like, a severe stroke or, like, you know, mm-hmm. like issue, that's your body starts twisting in weird ways. You can start something, like, we're still in the realm of this can still be grounded, which is, you know, sorry to keep reiterating my first point of, you know, the first two acts are the strongest word when we fully commit to the weird. It's like, I liked it before. Cause even his hand going all weird, it's like, I can still write that off as,
they're still like, I don't know what's going on. Which makes it so much more scary when you don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Also, we're doing like a Care Bears movie next time because, like, I have to live in this apartment and, like, I need something happy and lovely.
But yeah, so Annie in the meantime, while this is going on, because they're trying to contact Annie about her son busting his own face on a desk. She is like diving into her mom's archives and basically finding out that Joan was part of this group that her mom was in.
Yeah.
And that's when she finds the picture of her mom in a wedding dress with gold being rained on her.
And she had read that segment of the book earlier that like gold, you know, you'll be rained in.
Yeah.
You know,
she, yeah. She reads it. Yeah. She reads about pie chart. And so when Gabriel Byrne comes home with his son, who's he's interrupted writing that email that I mentioned earlier about like Annie's in the midst of this nervous breakdown. He's just so tired of her shit. And she's also at this point found, climbed up into the attic where there's been a bunch of flies and found her mother's dead body is up there.
Yeah. Headless, dead
headless,
body. Yeah.
Headless dead body. And so like he comes home and she is outside just screeching at him about like, oh my God, this is all crazy, blah, blah, blah. Like she has found out what's going on and he is not interested.
Yeah.
Cause she has just done so much to this family and he's so tired of her shit. And she is like, burn this book. She's already tried to burn the art book of Charlie's art book and caught fire, as we talked about earlier. But she's like, you need to do this for me. I'm so sorry. I love you. But this will, if you burn this book, this will get rid of me. Just do it. And he's like, I'm not doing it. I can't play this game with you anymore. I'm so tired. Then she's like, fuck it. Throws the book in the fire. She's like, I'll just do it. Throws it. Starts Gabriel Byrne on fire.
Yeah.
And there's a couple people I know that were
like, let's talk about nominative determinism.
Yes. Yeah. But I know some people that were very furious about that. Like, why did he start on fire? It's fucking occult magic, man. Like,
yeah.
I'm sure if you know occult magic, there's rules to it. But like for a horror movie shit, it made perfect sense.
No, in that case, no. It's just they're going, some stuff happened.
Got him.
I know a little bit about the stuff, and I'm pretty sure there's no rule there.
And yeah, and she is watching in horror, and then the shimmer kind of hits her, and she just whoop. And then next thing you know, Peter wakes up, and this is when shit gets crazy.
Yes. Now, I would like to read for my notes here. Shit. Crawling thing behind sun.
Yeah.
This is horrible. I hate horror movies. Thing is upper corner when he looks at burned dad. Creepy naked guy in doorway. Mom chases. This is fucked.
So why did you translate your notes into Japanese and then back again?
Well, I was trying to type real fast.
Oh. No, it's funny. When I saw this in the theater, I did not notice her in the upper corner until a guy I was seeing this with, I saw him lean forward and point. And then I was like, oh my God.
Well, did you see the thing before that? It's the thing behind him is when he's in bed, she like skitters in the background.
Well, that's the next shot.
Before that. Before she's in the upper corner, when he's still in bed, you can only see like the arm hem of her night robe.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Quickly skitter. Like it is fucked. And I notice it. And I'm, again, alone in my apartment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I haven't been in a relationship in 4 years. I'm so lonely and this fucking place is haunted now. Fuck you, John.
But you know, but if you think about it, that actually makes you more safe because you haven't made any kind of deals with the devil. None of your family has, as far as you know, but you're not with someone.
Oh, my mom is Azathoth. I didn't know if you knew this.
Sorry. How rude of me.
Yeah, my mom's the third Lord of Hell. Oh, I should have said this before we did the episode. Pie on my face.
I should have noticed that framed photo of your dad that says King in Yellow.
That's because he's got a pee fetish. But
I'm getting peed on and giving a thumbs up.
Yeah.
Anyway, so she is fully, like, demon now, and he, you see her like skitter behind him and he's not sure what's going on. Peter's like wandering around and he goes downstairs, sees his burnt to death father, turns around and sees again, like she's hiding in the rafters behind him, but he turns around and sees this cult member, the same guy that smiled at Charlie in the funeral, like with that same creepy ass smile, just nude in the doorway. Like, hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
And then this is the jump scare I was talking about where she just, then Toni Collette just appears out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And starts chasing him through the house. He escapes up into the attic. And yeah, just everything's at a fever pitch. Because he's in the attic and he's like apologizing to his mom. Like, I'm sorry, everything's going to be okay. And you hear this knocking.
Yeah, he starts calling her mommy, which is so rough.
And you hear this knocking at the bottom. It sounds like she's like pounding, trying to get in. And it cuts to her. She is up against the attic door, like on the ceiling, pounding her head into it.
Yeah.
He sees the noise finally stops. Sees where the grandma was is now this like ashen outline with his photo in the middle.
Yeah, with the eyes burned out.
Yeah. And then sees like some more cult people and starts hearing this noise and looks up and it's Annie now up in the ceiling cutting her own head off.
Yeah.
With a wire, which is just so just really.
It is a gross. It is a gross thing. But they also have this part where that like weird shining orb thing enters into him.
Yeah. Well, because he jumps out the window.
Yeah.
He's like, he's seeing all this. He's like, oh my God. Jumps out the window. You hear Annie's body hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor.
Yeah.
And you just see, and I kind of like for how awful and big everything is, there's just this tiny little spark, basically. You see this like kind of like shadow pass over him. And this tiny little spark just kind of floats down and just whoop. Like it's not even like a flash happens over him. It just, this thing just hits him. He kind of wakes back up.
And now he's fully Pychart.
Yeah. And wanders. And he looks up. He sees Annie's now headless body floating into this treehouse, which never, well, not treehouse, but this like, it's essentially a treehouse, which we haven't talked about. It's like this thing that's been in the background this whole time. Like things have been happening in the treehouse. Like Charlie's been sleeping in there, Annie's been sleeping in there, and he goes up there, and all the cult is up there, heads bowed, most nude except for Joan. He goes up there and sees this, the inside of the treehouse has grown.
Yeah,
this is this weird like a nightmare logic where it's like it's so big it can now fit all of these people. And there's this statue of Pychart with Charlie's head, Charlie's desiccated head.
And it's done as
a crown.
It's done as that like kind of Jesus with like the sun rays behind kind of style, or maybe even like Peter and like rays of sun with a flesh crown on top of on top of her head. And like this marionette body, which it's very creepy.
Yeah,
but it's also the reason I started that was it's what Charlie was drawing when she had the pigeon head.
Yes.
She was trying to sculpt the crown and this thing that you know eventually pays off. So it goes back to was Paimon in her the whole time.
Yeah. Well, and what I like is that Peter is basically expressionless through the whole time. Like he does a sound.
Yeah,
just sort of as a way to let you go. Like okay, no, he is like. Whatever Charlie was is now him now. And while it's all happening, the music is this like ecstatic reverie isn't the right word, but like it's just this big sound essentially. Like it's really awesome. And actually something it made me think is the same thing kind of happens towards the end of his next movie, Midsummer, whereas like the end, like the music reaches this big fever pitch. But he's up there. And this is a moment I like too, is that the whole time Joan is talking to him and is saying, hey, you're Paimon. We love you.
Yeah, Charlie, you're right. You are Paimon, one of the eight kings of hell. We give you this healthy male host.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote that down because I'm like, oh, well, there it is.
Yeah, there's the bow. Yeah, may you bind humanity the same to us, the same way we are bound to you. The whole time, it's just on Peter.
Yeah.
And it's this upsetting thing because he kind of, you don't know how to read it exactly because it's not, he's not reacting. So it's this thing where he's confused and put upon whatever. Is he actually, I don't know. I just really like that. And you see her in the background, like get the crown off and put it on him. And then it cuts to this long shot of them bowing to him and boom, over to credits with Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now, I think is the name of the song.
Yeah. What a ballsy choice for an end credits thing. My line is, what a great ending song, ! Holy shit, ! Ballsy, !
Yeah. So in terms of what we were talking about earlier, I think when the shimmer thing hits Annie at the end, like she's Paimon there.
I mean, I have a hard time arguing against that point, except for the fact that it ruins the logic of how to summoning of the demon works.
That's your problem.
Just let's pretend I've never heard of an occult thing. The logic of this movie is it takes a multi-generational spell that involves death and all this horror to bring up this demon thing to take host.
Mm-hmm.
Except for when the mom needs to knock her head on a roof where it could just pop in.
Disagree, because it's been showing up this whole... If you take that shimmer, that little orb thing, is Paimon. It's been showing up
never in somebody's body, where it seems like the entire point of this is try to give Paimon a body. So if it can just so easily take one, it just seems that's...
But if the thing is it wants a male host. So if it's taking a female host...
But why couldn't it just take a male host?
Don't know. I mean, yeah, like...
That's
like,
right. It just intrinsically... Like the internal logic...
But it also says in the book... That she looks and says it will attack the most vulnerable person, and that's never been Peter. Like Annie has always been more vulnerable.
Yeah, than Peter. Yeah. No, I got it. It's just it. it just seems like either don't do the setup work for the bedrock of how the spell works, or ascribe to it stronger. So if you're saying it takes a generation to bring a Paimon and it does attach itself to a blah 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 blah, totally makes sense. But
I don't think it takes a generation because she tried with her son, like Lee tried with her son, and her son, like she was trying to put,
but the mother people into it. But the mother didn't do any work. So grandma tried to do the spell, mm-hmm. right? And I think grandma laid the trap work to have the spell work on the next generation down. That's why she wrote the postcard saying all of your sacrifices will be worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So there needs to be a sacrifice. There needs to be a spell done. There needs to be this ritual to happen.
Right.
To make Paimon take flesh.
Yeah.
If he can just take flesh, even just female flesh, it seems like he would just do it. Like, it just seems like...
But it says he's not, like, he's naturally male. He doesn't want to be in a female body.
That's fine. It just seems... Don't establish the... You don't have to have it be Paimon. You could have... I don't know.
But it is Paimon.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying it's... If you need to... I'm trying to think of, like, an easier way to put this. Like, oh, okay. If you need to put your key in a car in the door, like mm-hmm. in the old school before you had to do... Key in the car, turn the key in order to have the door open. And you're establishing that. And then later you just open the door without the key. It's not that big of a deal, but it's still like, well, you made the point of establishing that you need to put the key in the door, turn the
handle. Yeah, but these are completely different things, because the whole thing is like, so she had a male child that she kept away from her mom.
Yeah.
That her mom couldn't do what she needed to do to get the thing into
the
mom.
No, but that's what I'm saying. But the mom's dead. So how does it get into anybody? Like, what I'm saying is, if there needs to be this giant ritual to make a thing happen,
yeah,
and then at the end, the giant ritual doesn't need to happen to have the thing happen. It just kind of intrinsically doesn't work with itself.
I think the ritual did happen. I think the ritual was inviting it into the home with the family there.
Yeah.
And then, like, other things needed to happen in order for it to get to Peter. They needed to expel Peter from the body.
Yeah.
But I think there were things, there were machinations in place. I don't think it was.
Yeah, no, I just think it's internally the logic of the thing doesn't work.
I disagree because they set everything up. They told you everything you needed to know about it. They're like, I kept my child away from my mom, my male child, so I gave her Charlie. She thought Charlie was going to be a male child.
Yeah.
That's why it's Charles. And then she's doing all this stuff. Paimon does not like being a not male child.
Yeah, yeah.
So in order for Paimon to become fully into power, like he finally gets Annie at her most vulnerable, after eliminating the threat of Gabriel Byrne, then she can deal with Peter. Peter dies, gets into Peter.
Yeah, I know. It's overly complicated. If that's all you need,
you're upset at the occult for being overly complicated.
No, what I'm saying is, if you're setting up an overcomplicated system and then have a simple solution to it, it makes the... Because again, I like the
what's
first...
What's the simple solution?
Well, because if he can take in control of any female character, she could have just choked out any male, wait for him to be half dead, and then pop into him.
I don't think... But I think it's got to be... I mean, the fact that it's called Hereditary tells me that it's got to be something with Queen... Because the fact that she's Queen Lee or Queen Lei end tells me it has to be some sort of relation to her or something, that something happened. But it's also just that it's not just any male. It's Peter.
Right? No, but she could have just choked Peter out while he's sleeping. If the idea is that he needs to be... I just like... So the reason that he can have his body taken over is because he jumped out of a window?
Well, he died.
No, but I mean, she could have just killed him. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, if the solution is he just needs a body to jump into, that body is way easy to get to way earlier. Mm-hmm. Like, when it's a baby.
But maybe he wasn't vulnerable enough. Because if Paimon's going to attack the most vulnerable soul, maybe he's not, you know, he needed to get to that nadir of despair.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I just think it's overly... It doesn't pay off, like, it doesn't intrinsically make, it's not like it's wrong. It just doesn't, like, follow the same internal logic of earlier. Like, if you set up, like, some dumb shit, like, fucking Harry Potter. I know I bring it up a lot, but, like, Harry Potter, like, the brooms fly because of a spell. Mm-hmm. But if at one point you go, well, no, the brooms fly because I've got broom juice in it. Now, those two things both make sense within the universe, but, yeah. Well, no, you establish that there's a thing there. Like,
I still don't understand why that analogy has to do with this.
So grandma is around and she said, like, oh, I kept the son away from him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But if there's this pretty goddamn powerful thing that can pop into, like, the mother obviously is mentally unsound. It's established.
But it doesn't seem like it can just pop. It seems like things needed to happen for it to pop into something.
Yeah, I guess it's the things that happen just don't sit with me, considering the person that would make it happen was dead to start it. Like, the grandmother is the one that's the enactor of this.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, it just seems like Paimon would be able to, like, pop into the mom and kill Peter when he was 6 months old or whatever. Like, it just...
That didn't happen. Because it was Charlie, because it wasn't... I think because the fact that the grandma wanted to feed it...
Yeah.
Feed Charlie made me think that it had something to do with that.
Yeah.
You know? Like, there's certainly stuff that's not fully fleshed out.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the mystery, the part of the horror is you not knowing and the family not knowing of being put upon by these forces that they don't understand. So I don't think it's as simple as all that.
Yeah, I just think the intrinsic kind of logic of it is like it's I think I'm having the same problem that you have with time travel stuff that I don't have with time travel stuff, where it's like that, where it's just like, yeah, there's an intrinsic kind of doesn't work for me in the way that like the logic kind of not even contradicts, but doesn't like jive perfectly well with itself.
Okay. And again, I don't want to get into the time travel thing again, but my thing is the time travel thing for me, like in the case of Interstellar, like boils down to just like, you don't have a story. Whereas this is more just the story doesn't work, I guess.
Yeah. But if you fix the clock tower,
uh-huh,
then his arms will start disappearing.
That's true.
Yes.
They cut that out.
Yeah, and then my last note is the last few scenes, it reminded me of a Dark song, just sort of putters out to vague nude people doing Nightbreed.
See, this was so much more of a sad. I mean, we've just covered this, but this was much more of a satisfying ending for me than a Dark song.
Oh no, but me as well. But like Dark song was made for like $1.350, and this is a real movie. So it's when I'm comparing the two, I'm comparing the two on very much like community theater versus
What did I just watched this movie, The Burrowers, which was a horror movie. It was okay. It wasn't great. It had that guy from Lost that married the like 16-year-old. Remember that whole thing? I his name's like Doug Hutchins or something. Her name is Courtney Stodden.
Yes, I do remember this. Yeah.
He's in it briefly, but like the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, oh, this is like a straight to video version of Bone Tomahawk, which is a great horror movie.
Yeah.
I'd recommend that. But it was like, this is, I forgot people still do this.
Yeah.
Where it's like, even though we don't have straight to video anymore, that people still make like knockoff versions.
Yeah, yeah. We're at the bar the other night, we were watching Dragon Wasp, starring Corey Nemec from Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was delightful. So I think that's anything else about Hereditary?
It's great. I love it. And
I definitely watch it. Like, as much as like most of my dialogue was complaining, like, I really love the first two thirds.
I will say, watch, even though like you're like, ah, oh, fuck you, I watch this alone, watch Midsommar. Midsommar is a lot like, the first like quarter of it, maybe, when I saw in the theater, my girlfriend was like, I don't know if I can watch this whole thing. Like, this was very intense. But the rest of it is a lot like, it has a sense of humor about itself.
Yeah.
And it's a lot like, it's daylight horror. It all takes place in the day. And it's less emotionally destroying. It's more just like a neat, there's still a cult involved. But the horror is less terrifying, I would say. But it's a great movie. I recommend it highly.
Yeah. So if I ever have a live-in girlfriend to protect me from the spoopies, or...
I would say it's not nearly as scary as Hereditary.
Yeah, but Hereditary was really scary. So I'm going to wait on that. But watch Midsommar. He was great on Mad Men.
Gremlins 2.
Yeah.
Which is terrifying.
Yes. Letter Moulton is horrific.
Yes.
John, I think it's about time that I finally forgive a certain leaf for becoming a Joaquin.
What's a Joaquin?
Joaquin Phoenix.
Oh.
You know, that guy from Her?
Oh. Her?
Yeah, the movie we're doing next week. You know, that's like at the end, you know, where like we have a sudden change in tone as if we went on pause and tried to pick out what movie we're doing next time. That's what's happening right now. So we're going to do Her.
Her?
Yeah. Like Hereditary. Nice. Except without the editary.
Nice. All right. There was too much editary in this movie, so I'd like a little bit less.
Yes. So in place of editary, we have Scarlett Johansson playing a robot lady.
Yeah. They could have gotten a robot to play that role. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes, they could have gotten a robot lady to play that role, but I believe Jeff Bezos has the patent on trying to make that happen. That or the people will be on Google's Waymo. There's going to be a robot uprising happening, and unless we elect Yang, there's no chance for us to get out of it.
No Waymo, but I'm excited for this movie.
Yang Gang. Her, starring Joaquin Phoenix, came out, I don't know, 5 years ago or so. We're going to watch that. Do it. I won't get scared by it, though it will make me feel incredibly lonely, the other thing I hate feeling.
Woo!
So continuing the trend of my podcast experience is just making my life worse.
Slowly gaslighting you into oblivion.
Indeed. Thank God I live in a basement full of radon and I'll be dead soon.
Yay!
All right. See you next time.
Bye.